Representative Fritz, am I moving the minutes of the March 10th meeting? Representative Fritz, move the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Seibert, you're not on the committee. Who would like to move the bill? Representative Davis would be honored to move the House File 1397, be recommended to pass and re-referred to, does this go somewhere else?
Committee on Civil Law.
How do you know that? That's good.
I'm sorry, it goes to Public Safety.
To the Committee on Public Safety.
Okay, Public Safety.
That's exactly what you said, Representative Davis. Representative Seibert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an agency bill coming from Public Safety. It's a fairly simple bill. Currently, private detectives and protective services and agents, they can display certain things on their badges. Some of the things that are prohibited are the words police, constable, highway patrol, sheriff, trooper, law enforcement, or any municipality. What this bill will do simply is just add the word state patrol to that list of prohibited terms. It's fairly straightforward. The Department of Public Safety supports that, and it's brought out by when we went through the revisor's office. That was found that it was left off.
Hey, do you have any testifiers?
I have none right now. We have somebody, if any technical questions, I have somebody I can call down.
Yes. Would anyone like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, any questions from members? Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seibert, what's the difference between a highway patrol and a state patrol you're adding? Is it redundant, or should it stay in there, or should we eliminate highway patrol? Or?
Representative Seibert.
What's the scoop?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, the two terms actually mean the same thing, but it could be misconstrued by someone that sees a badge or a piece of material from somebody from Protective Services. They could be state patrol or highway patrol.
Representative Rukavina. Seeing no further questions, Representative Davids renews his motion that House File 1397 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Chair moves House File 1398 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Civil Law. Is that where it's going?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Representative Seibert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one's a little bit more complicated. This is another agency bill. And what this basically does, currently for unclaimed property, this hasn't been updated since 1981. And when there's unclaimed property, the state is required to advertise certain properties throughout the state. That's being held. Currently, there's about 1 million people that have unclaimed property that the state either has or got rid of and used the money. What this does is makes three changes to the statute. Cooperatives are no longer have to notify the Department of Commerce of unclaimed property, but must simply mail a notice to the last known address of the owner and publish a notice in the official publication of the cooperative. Commerce officials can make a public notification of unclaimed property in a manner that's best fit, thereby relieving the mandate to publish the names and last known addresses of local newspapers, basically using the internet, lists that can be accessed by telephone, stuff like that. And thirdly, laws that from 1981 are updated and strengthened to prohibit encroachment by a company absorbing an unclaimed assets instead of surrendering the unclaimed assets to the state. I do have a couple testifiers that can help further elaborate as well.
Okay, well, why don't we take the testimony right now?
So let's call Mr. Patrick Sexton and Mr. Dennis Wiggs.
Please introduce yourself and speak.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Munkwitz. I work at the Department of Commerce. Representative Seibert pretty much explained the bill. There are the simple three sections that he explained. A change in co-ops that would relieve some unnecessary burden on both the co-ops and the departments. It just relieves them of a reporting requirement. The second section does deal with the advertising. And the third section is just tightening up some existing law that the Attorney General's office recommended we do as a result of a recent court case. That basically is an outline of the bill. I think that we probably have some questions, maybe.
Questions from members? Representative Davids?
What are we doing
there? With the advertising?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that most members are probably familiar with this tabloid that we published last year. Throughout the state, we had a three-phase campaign of our advertising of unclaimed property last year. This 60-page tabloid appeared in the Star Tribune in September. We had a 44-page tabloid that appeared in the Pioneer Press in June, and then we had a 16-page tabloid that appeared in the Duluth Tribune News in December. Also in December, we had many legal notices in 11 other newspapers around the state. What we're simply doing, or what we're trying to do, is the current law requires that we publish names, addresses by county of the last known address of a person that holds unclaimed property. We're looking for some flexibility in that. We want to try to tap other areas of media, radio, TV, web ads. Instead of being tied to publishing 40,000 names like we did last year in a paper like this, a one-time event where folks have the ability of that given day to look into this. If they don't get the paper, if they're on vacation, etc., they're probably not going to see their name in the tabloid. So currently, well, why don't I stop there? I know you have another question.
Representative David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been in the tabloids quite a bit lately. it seems, do these, any of these end up in papers of District 13 D, like Fillmore County Journal or Duke County News or Prince Valley Tribune or anything like that, Press and Republican?
Mr. Monquist?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, there wouldn't be a tabloid that would be published in a newspaper of that size, but there would be a legal notice, potentially, that would list folks' names.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
I didn't say my question real quick. Currently, the way it is now, today these show up, I don't remember seeing these show up in my papers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, no. A tabloid like this would not have appeared in your paper.
Well,
Representative Davis
and members, what I do is I go through, I get the list, and I notify everybody in my district from me as a non-campaign disbursement. I notify them. I suppose that'll be changed now too. Board of the hearings. I think we notify them, or I do personally, in the district I represent. And if this doesn't even get out my district, why wouldn't we let you guys use other ways to do it? Is that what you're trying to do here? That's a fine piece of legislation. Fine piece of legislation.
Appreciate that. Further questions? Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Monquist, in line 14, it says, line 13 and 14, says manner and frequency the commissioner determines to be most effective and efficient. I guess my question is just how we're going to define that. When you and I visited yesterday, I believe you indicated that the figure is around 25% that the department currently experiences. My suggestion to you at that time, and I'd reiterate it now, is that we have the ability to take a look at this again in a year or 2 years if this legislation goes through. In fact, my concern being that if that figure, hopefully it goes up, hopefully it becomes 35 or 50%. If it goes down and it's 15%, that we, quite honestly, put you on the spot, get you on the record today that says we do not believe that that is effective or efficient under the language that we proposed, and therefore we would want to go to the other, just if you would, just kind of address that issue for us and what you expect and what the current numbers are.
Mr. Monquist.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, you're right. The 25% is the average of what we return to the rightful owners of the unclaimed property that we hold. We certainly would be looking at what effect this may have if this does pass. We would certainly be looking over the course of the next 2 years how the response has either increased or decreased as a result of this suggested law change. So we definitely would be looking at those stats. And I assume that we are going to see an increase in how much money we're returning to the rightful owners, just because we are experiencing such an increase in the website hits that we get on our comprehensive unclaimed property list. Currently, in the last 12 months, we have received 270,000 hits of folks looking at a comprehensive list of all the unclaimed property that we hold. Just to remind you, this tabloid is printed once a year. Those names will never be advertised in print again, or at least that's been the practice since the program's been around, as far as I know. So I think that we're moving in a different area, you know, in the way that industry has moved related to technology, and we just want to try to take advantage of some of those avenues that are available to us.
Thank you.
Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to point out that their advertising budget, printing and advertising, is $120,000 a year. This little tabloid takes about $100,000 of that. So this isn't really a money-saving effort on the Department of Unclaimed Property. What it does, though, is give them a latitude to do other things, take out individual ads in papers like Representative Davis was talking about, get a banner ad on the Star Tribune, things like that. It gives them a lot more latitude, and I really believe that they'll touch a lot more people. As he said, he got 270,000 web hits on their website this last year, a lot more than they thought they were going to get. So I think this is a good effort.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Seibert, I think you just answered some of my question there. I just had concerns for people that don't use Internet, because we have quite a few of them in my district that don't. I hadn't realized that they don't get this publication everywhere. So I think the fact that he mentioned that this will give them more flexibility within the department, but I just would like to assure that people that do not have web access still have access, or perhaps even have greater access to learning about this through other means, because there are still quite a number of them. Thank you.
Representative Ivar.
To that, Mr. Chair, there's a 1-800 number that they can call to get access to the information. And I was told by Mr. Plunkwitz and Mr. Jefferson that that will be advertised even more than it is now with that $100,000. So there'll be other avenues as well.
Can I just add something to that? I want to make it clear that although your paper may not be getting a tabloid like this, there would be a public notice in the counties of your district that would list the names. And it would be do the same thing that this does, but we just don't need to have a tabloid for each of the 87 counties. You know, some counties may only have 10 people that we need to advertise. So that does take place today. There is something in print today. And we do know that everybody isn't going to go to the web. We know that newspaper is going to be the number one thing that we're spending money on in the next 3 to 5 years, I expect. But we just want some additional flexibility, just not to be tied to have to do it that way.
Okay, Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seibert, could you answered a couple of my questions here. The last question I have then is, say in the Bemidji Pioneer, the West Itasca Review, where they advertise these listings now, are they not going to be listed in that way in the paper, and they'll be just an 800 number now? Is that what you're saying? Along with a web address, maybe? Because I share Representative Saylor's concern about Internet access. There's a lot of people up in north central Minnesota who don't have access to the Internet or aren't comfortable using it yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, Pat Sexton from the Department of Commerce. Just to give you an example of what we're looking at, that we would advertise today once in the Bemidji paper. What we'd like to do is advertise multiple times, and maybe depending on the number of people that we have listed, we could actually list the names. Or maybe we can just say there are 130 people in Bemidji that have unclaimed property. But the goal would be to do that more than just once a year, maybe once a quarter. That's our goal, is to be a little bit more flexible and advertise more frequently.
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then the ultimate goal, obviously, is to get more people claiming their property, correct?
It's that their property.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Representative Wathler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Seibert, or perhaps Mr. Marquardt. The first part of the bill deals with distributions related to cooperatives, and yet it has a much more limited distribution. You only need to mail it to the last known address, which could be 7 years old, and then you publish it in the cooperative's newsletter, which would probably be sent to that same bad address. And is there a reason why this wouldn't fall into, or perhaps it would, the broader announcement or greater accessibility that you just described for persons with unclaimed property?
Mr. Monkowitz?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can't see your name, but currently the co-ops do not have to turn the property over to the state. They simply have to do a reporting to the state saying these have been deemed lost or abandoned properties. They then have the ability to turn that property over to a nonprofit organization. So the money never comes to the state. Usually the payments are so small that they don't hit the $100,000 or the $100 threshold that we use when we do advertise folks' names. So chances are they would never appear in print anyway. But the key thing there is that right now the co-ops do not have to turn that property over to the state. They simply have to do a reporting to us that they have these holdings, and then they will then at some point in the future turn those over to a nonprofit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just got a check for $455 because I finally claimed some property. So hopefully that's not them paying me off to vote for this bill. But I just want to ask a question to either of the testifiers from Commerce. I remember those seeing, and actually the reason I found out is because I had somebody from my neighborhood saw my name in the paper and said, hey, you got some money coming. So it works well that way too. But I seem to remember last year you also utilized newspapers in far of doing a news story where Governor Ventura had some unclaimed property, and you were using a different way of getting at it, which would probably attract more people than some folks may be coming across an advertisement or a legal listing. I don't read the legal listings. Just don't have time to do it, as I'm sure a lot of other folks don't. But I seem to remember a press hit where it was Governor Ventura has unclaimed property. See if you're one of the thousand some others that do as well. Is there still a plan to do those kind of things? Because I think that really can grab attention, too, and still utilize the newspaper in a different way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Curtis, absolutely. If we can find unique items like that, we definitely want to take advantage of it. And we did issue a news release statewide, and some radio stations and some newspapers did pick up on it. So we will definitely be continuing that.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just found a unique point for you, Mr. Sexton. Representative Sertich claims $415 and buys rolls for the Commerce Committee.
From the Gunther's
grocery store.
He's looking to be in the ad.
We have two amendments on the bill. The first, let's start with the A2. The A2, I'm told, is a technical amendment. I think we were warned that it was coming, but obviously the time came in afterwards. Mr. Pender, would you like to kind of describe what this does so the committee can decide on taking it up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This amendment, I discovered as I was doing the bill summary yesterday that the bill amends Chapter 308A, which is the older chapter dealing with cooperatives, and there's a newer chapter, 308B, that has exactly the same provision in it dealing with cooperatives, and that wasn't dealt with in the amendment. So this is simply taking the equivalent section in the new cooperative chapter and doing exactly the same thing. And you can see, I think, that the amendment amends a section that is the same as Section 1 in the bill. It's just in a different chapter of statute. And then the amendment also does the equivalent thing with Subdivisions 1 and 2 in that same section of law, 308B.735, and lines 19 and 20 of the amendment. It repeals those subdivisions, and that's exactly what the bill itself does with the same subdivisions in Chapter 308A. And I talked with the Department of Commerce about this yesterday and asked them if they agreed that this needed to be done, and they said yes.
Mr. Sexton and Mr. Monkowitz, heads are nodding. So, if there's no objections, this does seem to be technical. The chair will move the A2 amendment. Any comments? All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion fails. The A1 amendment? Representative Yaros, for you?
Yeah.
Can offer that?
And yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Yaros moves the A1 amendment. And on this one, the committee was warned ahead of time that it was in drafting. And so if there's no objection, I'm going to just say that it met the 24-hour rule. Representative Yaros?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, my philosophy is political and personal philosophy is to keep what's good in old-fashioned that's good and accept the new things that are good. And I'm an old-fashioned guy. I don't like computers. I like newspapers. And I like to see it in the newspaper. I don't know those of you that were on tax committee. I distributed when President Mallory complained about his old folks in Minneapolis not being able to file taxes by internet. I had that nice picture. I was going to show it to you how difficult it is for us older people to struggle with these new machines. And so I would like to reinstate the existing language to require that notices be published in newspapers.
Okay, would anyone like to testify for or against the amendment?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. My focus is, of course, on Section 2, the part of the bill that would eliminate the longstanding, decades-old requirement that these lists of owners of unclaimed property be published in newspapers. I emphasize, we have no problem with giving more flexibility to the department. That's fine. But if you're not careful, what you're going to do is deprive thousands of Minnesotans of millions of dollars of their money that the state gets every single year because they will not know that it exists. Now, many of you know, many of you heard me before in other contexts, the Newspaper Association has worked hard for years to eliminate public notices that have outlived their usefulness. Last year, another bill came through the legislature and was enacted that did that very thing. But you have to remember the numbers involved here and the experience we have with Commerce and in newspapers for publishing these lists. $50 to $70 million a year is returned to the state as unclaimed property. That's a pretty steady number. Of that sum, only about 25% has been returned lately. 75% defaults to the state of other people's money because the word does not get out. Now, you've seen what the department has done recently to get the word out. It's not a very effective device. I agree with that. I agree this tabloid format stuck just in the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press is not a good way to do it. But if you give them the flexibility to do other things that this bill provides, what you're giving them really is the flexibility to do less, to spend less money. And they will spend less money. If I'm selling automobiles or groceries, I will guarantee you I do not take out small ads on the radio and the newspaper saying, go to my website and see the deals I have for you. Nobody does that. And there's a reason they don't do that, because it doesn't work. Now, why am I a little skeptical? It's not abstract. In 2002, just 3 years ago, and contrary to the law, a previous commissioner of the department decided not to follow the law, and they didn't publish these lists. It was an interesting result. The phone stopped ringing. We know for a fact from that year that this was a very bad experience. The woman who administers this program in Commerce told us when we asked her how the response was in 2002 without the newspaper publication, this is a direct quote, it was a non-response. The department spent about $10,000 that year on getting the word out, about $50 million of the taxpayer money. Why should I not conclude that's what they might do again if they're given this quote-unquote flexibility? That's our concern. What do people, even with these tabloids, as one of the members of this committee mentioned, what do people do? Our long experience is they look at it, they look for their name, and then they run down everybody else's name they know. And you can do that very quickly. I'll give you a quick example. This is the ad in the St. Cloud Times from a year or two ago. Within a couple of minutes, you can scan down this list very effectively. Are you going to go to the web and look for your neighbor's names? No. And there's a lot of folks in this state who don't have access to the Internet, who don't have access to computers, who are largely going to be cut out of this. I would pass one other fact along here. One of the witnesses said that this is part of the 1981 law, and indeed it is. You should understand that the 1981 law is a uniform law that most states in the country have enacted as part of the uniform law process. The Uniform Law Commission recommends publication of these lists. In 1995, the Uniform Law Commission updated the Unclaimed Property Act, again recommending publication of the list. We don't object to flexibility. What we are concerned about is if you give them the flexibility this bill does, it's going to cost your constituents a lot of money based on our experience. Now, one final word. We have proposed to the department so far, we have not been embraced for doing so, a very simple solution that would solve everybody's problem. And that is this. Allow the department, allow the state to assess a small service charge on the money that is returned to the owners. The current law prohibits the state from assessing any fee, any service fee, despite the fact that the state and its taxpayers do incur costs, obviously, in administering this program. There are a number of states that allow this. A 2 or 3% fee, service charge, if you will, on the unclaimed property returned to the owners would earn for the state $200,000 or $300,000 a year. Who could object to having $3 withheld from $100 for getting their money back? Why doesn't that work to solve this problem? That's new money to the state. As I say, we think that's a simple solution. It has so far been rejected. So, members, that's my pitch. I mean, obviously, the newspapers have a selfish interest in this. But we also have a lot of experience about what's really happened over the years. This is one of the most effective public notices in Minnesota statutes. And you should hesitate to change it.
Questions from members? Representative House?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only problem I would have living in Walker, Minnesota is I don't buy the newspaper. I get it all online. So I think Representative Seibert has a good bill here.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Anthonson, I think if we're going to consider, and that's a whole different concept, whether or not there ought to be a revenue raising here, I think we ought to look at the people who actually have the unclaimed counts that are turned over. The people that I know who have found their names on these lists are often people who are listed in the Minneapolis phone book with the exact same address. I mean, the effort that's made sometimes before things are turned over to the state, I think, is pretty minimal. And if we really wanted to reduce the cost of publishing and sharing this, I think we could actually look to the people who have these accounts that they turn over to the state rather than put a minimal effort into finding the rightful owners. And I think that asking the people who funds those are to give it up in order to increase outreach, I don't think is a place we ought to go today.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And does the bill we're working on basically gut the bill? Is that kind of what it does? Or maybe we could get me off if he likes the amendment.
Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis, I think it does gut the bill. I think it takes the intent out of taking that $100,000 and finding different ways to notify people. Then we take the budget.
Well, Representative Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the person that just testified here, you mentioned that the Department of State Government might not actually spend all the money they have, and I find that not the case in my history realm.
Mr. Chairman, we do have an example here from 2002 where they indeed did not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Any further questions? Representative Yaros, do you have another comment?
Well, just, Mr. Chairman, you've heard, I think, the witness has explained it, and I'm still old-fashioned. I would like to not only be able to see it in the paper, but also save the consumers money. So I would move the amendment A1.
Representative Coles.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anfinson, you talked about the newspaper industry's self-interest in this, and I'm not proposing an amendment here or an amendment to the amendment, but if the department were to, if there were some language put into the bill that would require the department to spend $100,000 or continue funding this public notification procedure at the same level that it has, would the Newspaper Association drop its opposition to Representative Seibert's bill, or would you continue to be opposed? I mean, they're talking about continuing this, but I understand that that's only words, and I hear what you're saying about the previous commissioner's decision. But would the Newspaper Association continue to be opposed to the bill if language of that type were included?
Mr. Anthony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles. No. We think that history teaches newspaper publication has been a very effective way to get the word out to the people whose money this is. We think it can be improved, and we would we think you can do much better, for example, than publish these long tabs in a few newspapers. Publish the ads in every county in the state. You'll get the word out more effectively than you do now. The problem has been, and I acknowledge that, a budgetary one. The department is strapped like everybody else. And in fact, the last several years, they've dropped the amount of money they've spent. It's not just the 2002 experience. They have spent in the past considerably more money on getting the word out to people than they have the past few years for budgetary reasons. But it's still a matter of notifying people who have this money coming that it's there. And you have to be careful about how you approach that.
Further questions? Representative Satterfield? No, this is the amendment. Okay. All in favor of, we're going to vote on the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions to the bill? Representative Satterfield?
Mr. Chair, and is it Mr. Sexton? I just have a question about... like Land O'Lakes, one of the utility companies, do they just have to send to the last address, known address? That's all they have to do?
Mr. Representative Sutterstrom, yes, I believe that's in statute. That's correct.
I wonder why they don't have to publish the names. I'll just give an example. About 10 years ago, Land O'Lakes sent a letter to my father, who had been dead for 15 years, and somebody at the post office knew that was my maiden name, so they forwarded it to me. And it was like $1,600 from Land O'Lakes. And I asked them then when I called them, and they had sent to my dad's last known address a couple times, but it was just, if they would have published it in the paper, because I'm from a small town, I mean, probably 10 people would have called me and said, did you see that your dad's name is there and there's some money to your family. But I thought that was quite a bit of money, and it was just an accident that somebody that was my age saw that letter when they were going to send it back. So I think that it would be well if they published that once, anyway, in the paper.
If I can just briefly respond, I think we get tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of items of property, and they can come from insurance companies. So we would get a ton of names. I think you'd have to ask them if they would want to bear the cost of publishing that. I think the reason the state does it is they think all the money can go into the general fund, and that the state can do hopefully a little bit better job of trying to communicate to people that they have unclaimed property.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sarsha.
Okay, but the co-ops are separate. They're not part of this. Correct. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Saylor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Seibert, or any of the three of you, I just wanted to revisit that issue because, the issue of rural people that don't use internet being able to to see those lists in one form or another. And I quite agree on the tabloid. I don't think that's ever helped anybody up in my district. I don't know if it has or not. But I do think that publishing things in newspapers does simply because people read them. At least some people do. But anyway, but my point is just concern for these people. And then the question came up, what provision is there that there will be some way for folks that don't use web-based information systems to find out about the list?
Who would like to take that one? Mr. Monkowitz.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative. We will, you know, it is certainly our plan that we will be taking out ads in some of those small town local newspapers. They may just read a little bit differently. It may not list the names of 100 folks. It may say 100 folks in this area have unclaimed property. Contact us at this phone number or visit our website. We're finding more and more that younger folks are going to the website. They're looking for mom and dad. They're looking for grandma and grandpa, and they're finding those folks, and we're getting their property back to them. So I think that the web is working, and it's going to work in all parts of the state. And, yes, some parts of the state don't have that, but I hope that what we'll do in the newspapers in the future will still meet that need.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Marquardt. I was wondering if you would consider publishing a listing that would be available to each public library. I don't know how many there are. If there's 1,000 in the state, it would certainly be dramatically less expensive than the inserts in the paper. But if your local ad said this is a place where you can go to look at the listing, quite honestly, I'm concerned about the person-to-person outreach that we've heard works effectively even with some of our peers, where people not only look to see their own name, but they look to see if there's anyone else they know that they could help out. And that might be more facilitated with that sort of thing. I can see a number of people would go to the library and look through the list and actually help out some of their neighbors. It seems like we ought to have something that's not just an ad to a phone number or to the Internet.
Mr. Chair, I'll just respond to that quickly. We have done that in the past, and in the non-event year that Mr. Anfinson spoke about, that it was the route that they went. They did publish a list, sent it to libraries in all 87 counties, took out notices and papers and said, go to your library, here's a list. That was 3 or 4 years ago. I would propose that folks probably have access to a computer in most of those libraries today, and they could just as easily go to that library and access the Internet and find the list there as well. But, you know, we certainly will look at all avenues of advertising, and that could be one thing we would look at is publishing a list at the libraries.
Further questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill is, you know, not a bad idea, but I would really like to see some reporting back to see whether it does make those numbers go up or not. I mean, I think we're a little bit flying in the dark here. And, of course, an awful lot depends on how good a job the department does in getting the advertising out. But, you know, I guess I don't necessarily want to put it in the bill, but, you know, could we have a commitment for some kind of report back to this committee on the progress?
Mr. Sexton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. Yeah, absolutely. The idea for this bill was to try to better manage. We took a look at how can we better manage this? How can we better communicate to people that they have unclaimed property? So, yeah, I think we'll be constantly looking at measuring how we're doing. Are we doing better? Are we doing worse? What can we do differently? And I'm hopeful that others at the Newspaper Association and Broadcasters Association and others would come to us with different ideas of how we can be a little bit more targeted, a little bit more effective in our communication.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but what about the report back? Would you report back perhaps to the committee chair or...
Okay, sure. We can do that.
Thank you.
Representative Rukmini.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, my experience around here, if you want them to report back, you better put it in the bill. Because it's sure we can do that at the table doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get done. But, you know, again, another experience that I've had around here is that technology was going to save the state of Minnesota hundreds of millions of dollars, and technology has cost the state of Minnesota hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and my prediction will be that this will cost more money, reach less people, and why don't we just give it to our local newspapers who could use the money instead of some web company down in the Twin Cities. So that's my spin on it. I'm voting no. Simple as that.
Right, good time to take a vote here. I think we're done with the discussion. The chair renews his motion that House File 1398, as amended, be recommended pass and re-referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Seibert. Representative Severson?
Bunch of money.
Representative Severson moves House File 1375 be recommended passed and re-referred to civil law.
You're right, 100%.
Yes, you are.
I never even thought about that. Okay, well, let's go get to the floor. You have an amendment ready for any subcontract.
Representative Severson, do you want to pick up the DE1 just to get in the order that you want to discuss the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's correct. I would. We have the amendment DE1, and I'd like to move that amendment for approval.
Representative Severson moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he wishes to discuss it. All in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair, to that point, before we vote.
Okay, we'll back up just a little bit. Representative Atkins?
Hand up. I think Brad acknowledged that I wanted to raise an issue with respect to it. Oh, that's with due respect. The DE1, I note at the top that it indicates 11:26 a.m. of the 14th. My concern is that we went looking. We were made aware that there was going to be a delete all. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that this has met the 24-hour rule. I believe that it is highly substantive. I mean, you've got multiple pages, and this isn't at the merits of the bill. There's some good parts, there's some bad parts, but there's some substantial changes in this bill. And when we sent Brian Dower from our staff to seek out the delete all yesterday afternoon about 3:00, he was told that it would be available within 2 hours. He returned at 5 or 5:30. And found one legislative assistant available who refused to share. I don't know if he was aware of whether it was there or not, but he wasn't able to contact Ms. Byers and would not release any delete all. It first became available, and I've been seeking it out because I knew it was coming, and I wanted to look at it. It's important to see the substantive changes that are in there. But it was not available to me then until this morning at about 10 o'clock. We caucused this issue among the DFL members at noon. No one in the room had received the delete all that I'm aware of. If you had, nobody shared that with me. And we're just now scrambling madly to try to get through the substantive changes in the bill, which may well be great. In fact, I think the folks have, as Chair Davids used to say, there's an effort at peace in the valley here as folks try to come together with concerns and address those. But it really handicaps our ability. I'm sorry. No, if you're...
I asked a quick question.
I know it's difficult to get information from two points of view, but my point on it is that if by letter of the law it met the 24-hour rule, because I see it was timed at 11:26, it certainly did not meet the spirit of your rule, which is to give folks adequate notice so that they can prepare amendments, so that they can prepare whether or not they want to have witnesses here to testify, or simply even to read the bill or the delete all when it's something of this substance and significance. With that, I would renew my objection and just say that we either take up the original bill and take the testimony or lay over the delete all until we have an opportunity to meet the 24-hour rule, at least in spirit. Thank you.
Just a minute.
Hey, Mr. Chair, to that point.
Can you hold on for just a minute? Okay. Just in talking to staff, Representative Atkins, it does sound like the amendment was in. There was some communication between DFL staff and committee staff, and the DFL staff was going to come up and get it at one point. I don't know if our staff was away at that particular time or not, but the amendment was there. I don't know if there's a timing issue and just linking up with staff. I'm kind of at a, I don't want to penalize Representative Severson if our staff weren't able to link up.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Atkins.
With due respect, my suggestion would be that we let the witnesses that have come here to testify discuss and present what testimony they may have. Representative Severson, as I understand, is a member of this committee, so I don't know that we are necessarily going to put him out. But I think in of a bill of this sort of significance that we at least ought to have an opportunity to review it, perhaps, and prepare amendments accordingly, and that's the whole purpose of the 24-hour rule. I guess I'd welcome Representative Severson's input on it as well. Hopefully he wants to abide by the rules.
Absolutely. Representative Severson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. I think, our endeavor, our purpose in getting this amendment forward was really to conform to a couple of the issues that your members from your committee or from your side of the aisle brought up, and I thought were good suggestions. One is imminent peril, and that's the one that's included in this particular revision. So I think in our effort to meet those concerns, we got it there ahead of time because of staffing and because things have been very busy. It could be that we didn't have it immediately available. I can give you my word that this is the only change in the bill, and it's in Section 10, which deals with the exception. Subdivision 10 of Section 2. And it's about five lines long. And we could move to the original portion of the bill, discuss that, hear the case, but I think, because this was something that we had acquiesced because at your request, and I think were some good points brought forward and was a good addition to the bill, I'd prefer to deal with the amendment, but it's up to the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins, let's deal with yours first.
And I believe Representative Mull may well be on the same topic. The only point, Representative Severson, is if that was the only change, you did a full-blown delete all for five lines?
Representative Severson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I guess there are a couple other changes I was not aware of. That was the substantive change to the policy issues. The others are a little clarifying on some of the verbiage in terms of definitions.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, there are substantive important changes that I have already found, and I'm still finding more as I'm trying to get through this. So this is not the only change by any means, and the others are not minimal technical things.
Representative Mull?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Atkins' point, I have heard from both sides on this bill quite a bit, constituents, and I didn't get the new copy until 12 o'clock, and I would really, I'm on the fence on the bill. And so in order so that I could really vote in a way that represents my district, I'd like at least 24 more hours before we had to do that. So I would please ask that you abide by the 24-hour rule for this amendment.
Representative Goodwin?
I would agree. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with that, too. This is substantive. We haven't had a chance to draft any amendments to that or given the same amount of time to as your member and your author has. So I think we need to lay this over.
Mr. Chair, I hope you wouldn't, because then you open it up where we can just offer amendments like we should be able to in committee, because basically what you're doing here is allowing a fresh amendment to come before this committee that nobody's really seen except for an hour or so ago. And so, you know how I feel about being able to offer amendments in committee without 24-hour rules. So I'm hoping you'll vote against them. We'll move on, and then from this point forward in this committee, we can offer amendments like we should be able to.
just by offering them at our own whim and pleasure.
Okay, Representative Stevenson, did you have something else to add?
Mr. Chair and members, I have no problem just presenting the original bill here. It gives us an opportunity to discuss it, bring the concept forward. We can look at the provisions that are made forth, and there'll be ample opportunity to make changes to those. The concept of this bill is really about good government. It's about reducing some of the litigation that typically takes place in the marketplace and get the owner and the builder together. And so I'm happy with either way we go on this, Mr. Chair, but I think it's, I'm willing to go with the original bill.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. It's my opinion that the amendment was in on time. I would ask the staff of all members make sure that you inquire as to amendments after the 24-hour rule, after that, after 12:30. The day before, and please communicate with Mr. Freeman about that. Whatever caused the communication problem, what we're going to do is we'll hear both and we'll lay it over and we'll act on the bill tomorrow. I want to make sure we're fair to everybody involved and make sure everybody gets their thoughts heard. Representative Goodwin.
Then, Mr. Chair, will we have an opportunity to draft amendments this afternoon and get them in time?
Sure.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, to that point, I think you're doing the right thing by laying the bill over. However, I don't have any amendments here in my packet from anybody other than D. And I guess there's a technical amendment that Mr. Pender told me about. But I think we got a 24-hour rule. And I think you're applying it fairly the way it should be. But let's get this bill out of here tomorrow.
Yes, that is a good point. There are no amendments, Representative Goodwin, to the...
Mr. Chairman.
There is Mueller. And what we'll do, Representative Mullery, to accommodate that amendment, if it needs to be redrafted for changes to the DE-1, we'll allow that. Representative Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, I didn't understand that. Are we going to be able to put in amendments to this delete all amendment and get them heard tomorrow or not?
No, just the we will take the amendments that were in within 24-hour rule from the last 24 hours because there were none drafted other than Representative Mullery's to the original bill.
What difference, Mr. Chair, does that make? What difference does that make? We're looking at a different bill now.
No, we're not looking at a different bill. We're looking at the DE-1 amendment.
Which is a delete everything amendment, so it is a different bill. For all practical purposes, it's a different bill, Mr. Chair. We should be allowed to address that bill in this committee. And we should be allowed to offer amendments to that delete all.
No, Representative Goodwin, no amendments were offered to the original bill. The delete all amendment was filed on time. Since there's controversy over when staff on the minority side got it, I'm allowing that we're going to lay it over so that you have time to review the amendment. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question. Pardon me, I was out of the room for a moment, but the amendment here in the packet that I understand is Representative Mullery's, did that make the 24-hour rule? Because if
yes.
It did, it's the amendment is to the delete all amendment. So that means
that's
that Representative Mullery got to delete all amendment within the 24 hours.
Mr. Chairman, can I explain that?
Yeah, actually, I think there is an explanation for that. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Howes, I got the bill yesterday morning. I wrote out a handwritten amendment, took it to the committee staff before, what was it, about noon or something like that,
sure.
Or around noon. Then it was. They sent it down to Mr. Pender for technical drafting to comply. They said that they'd rather have it treated that way, and then treated as, since mine was in on time, they would treat it as being within the 24 hours, but they had it drafted in technical form by Mr. Pender. So it was in, the language of it was in within before the 24 hours.
That is correct. Okay, let's go to the testimony. Representative Severson, Your bill is in front of us as originally drafted. Why don't you address that, and then also address, you can also address the changes in the DE1 amendment, and we'll, after we take all the testimony, have some discussion today, we'll lay it over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And what I'd like to do is just to start out with is just paint a little bit of a picture here, and then I'm going to hand some of the technical issues over to Ms. Mary Weaver. You know, one of the things that has been significant in Minnesota is that the cost of housing has been going up, particularly in some of our newer areas. And so what can we do as a legislature to try and rein in some of those costs? I'm a new homeowner. I've been in the house about 18 months. This is hypothetical. All of a sudden, the roof starts leaking. And so what's my recourse? At this point, I've got a 2- and a 10-year warranty. I've got some provisions, but what do? I probably call up my insurance company. My insurance company says, well, you know, that's not really covered under what your provisions are. I call up the builder. The builder says, well, I can't get you right now. I need to get you in about 2 or 3 weeks. And so my first recourse is my roof is starting to fall in, and I'm pretty ticked, so the next thing I do is go down to the local legal services and say, hey, what's my recourse on this? Of course, they pick it up because they say, you know what, this is a great deal. We can make some money here and we can get the house fixed. So this is one of those proposals that really just carves out a 90-day business period that says before all of that goes on, the builder has an obligation to that homeowner to say, you know what, you have a problem, I have a responsibility to address that. We're going to take a 90-day break here and basically say to the homeowner and to the builder that you have a criteria that you need to follow in order to rectify the situation. Now, 85% of the cases that are currently out there, about 85, can be resolved with this 90-day stint, which is going to significantly decrease some of the litigation process that we have currently going on in our builder's system. So what we're doing here is we're trying to carve out a process in which the homeowner and the builder are required to get together to negotiate and to come to a solution without going into litigation. And the caveat on that is that if after this 90 days that the solution cannot be found, that the process goes forward as it would have without this proposal. So nobody loses their rights. Nobody loses any of their opportunities here. It merely is somewhat of a cooling down period and a let's get together period to say, hey, let's resolve this issue at the lowest possible level. So having said that, that's the concept of the bill. The mechanics, you know, as we discuss them, will probably get a little intricate, but I think, you know, we've tried to go around to all the best, the special interest groups to those groups that are have a vested interest and get the feedback from them and bring everybody to the table and say, hey, what is best for the people of Minnesota? Having said that, Ms. Perry Weaver.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Pam Perry Weaver. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. We represent the residential construction industry here in Minnesota. In 2004, there were 1,657 complaints to the Department of Commerce about the residential construction industry. In 2004, we built 40,000 new homes and remodeled about 82,000 homes, existing homes. So if you take that percentage, it's about maybe 1.5% of complaints compared with the number of homes that we're building and number of homes that we're remodeling. While that may seem like a low percentage, 1,600 and some complaints to the Department of Commerce is too many about this industry. If you look at the way a builder and a homeowner's relationship is today, a homeowner is required by state law, under the home warranty law, to communicate with a builder in writing about the defect that they are seeing in their home. They're required by law. They've been required to do that since 1976 when the home warranty law was put into place. But there's nothing in law, that requires the builder to respond to the homeowner. Nothing. And if you ask the Department of Commerce, and I see that some of the enforcement people from the Department of Commerce are here, what some of the primary nature of the complaints of consumers about the residential construction industry are to the Department of Commerce, they will tell you, I think, that it's communication. There's a communication breakdown between the builder and the homeowner. The builder's not calling back because they don't want to, they're afraid to, they don't know how to fix the problem. So we believe that notice and opportunity to repair is a way to require the builder to communicate back to the homeowner in a timely fashion. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to go through, I'm a little unclear. Do you want me to go through the delete all, or would you like me to go through the original bill?
Well, I think the delete all is what we'll be acting on tomorrow.
Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and address that?
The delete all. Okay. Mr. Chair, Section 1 is definitions, and there was a change from the original bill in the delete all amendment in page 2, lines 10 through 13, subdivision 7. We changed the definition of a contractor so it conforms with current law. The contractor is defined in Chapter 327A in two different locations, and so we just redefine the definition of contractor so it's consistent with current law. So Section 1, our definitions. Section 2, pretty lengthy section, and basically it's the notice, the response, the inspection, the offer, the acceptance, and it's all the language that compels the builder and the homeowner to communicate with one another. The substantive change that we made in Section 2 of this bill is on line page 2, lines 31 through 33. We say we're concerned that in current situations, a homeowner, how are they supposed to know that this law was changed? So what we do is we require the builder, we added language to require the builder, upon receiving a notice from a homeowner, to let the consumer know what this notice and opportunity to repair law is right off the get-go, so they understand what the communication required is, requirement is. But essentially what all of Section 2 does is it says that a homeowner has to provide the builder with a written notice, nothing new, but they have to do it within 90 days before commencing a claim. They have to, the builder then within 30 days has to provide a homeowner with a written notice to offer to inspect. The builder inspects the defect claim and provide the homeowner with a written analysis of an offer regarding that defect. And finally, in Section 2, the homeowner then provides the builder with a written response regarding the offer. They can reject it if they want to, but they need to give us a reason why. I think the other substantive change in Section 2 is on page 5, lines 20 through 21. Actually, the trial lawyers asked us to look at this issue. Basically, we don't want to require a consumer to have to keep giving us notice after notice if they find defects. So basically, this says that additional defects can be included in any of the communication between the homeowner and the builder. The other new item in here is section subdivision 10, lines 26 through 30 on page 5. This is a Representative Mullery request that when we visited with him. He was concerned about imminent peril if a homeowner is in imminent peril. So we added some language, hopefully, that will meet some of the concerns that he had. So that's the other substantive change in Section 3. I'm sorry, Section 2. In Section 3 of the bill, we require the builder to include in all of their contracts for sale the notice and opportunity to repair language. So a consumer knows right when they purchase that house for the first time or they remodel that home that there's a notice and opportunity to repair provision in the law. Section 4 of the bill, basically, this relates to other laws regarding the home warranty law, the statute of limitations, and the Fair Claims Practices Act. The substantive change that we put in here on page 6, lines 22 through 25, is a request by the trial lawyers asking for some tolling provisions. So a consumer's statute of limitations wouldn't run out while they're working through this notice and opportunity to repair language. So that's a new provision there. We also added on lines 32 and 33, those are also new, that basically, again, we don't want to require the consumer to keep notifying the builder of claims. So this notice satisfies the notice that is already under Chapter 327A with the home warranty law. So they don't have to communicate with the builder two separate times under two different laws. I want to turn your attention to page 7, item F. This basically brings in the Fair Claims Practices Act. One of the issues that we've had is with the builders' insurance companies. We don't feel like they've been participating in a timely manner, and by putting this in, this is not new, this was in the original bill, that it will compel the insurance company to come to the table in a timely manner from the builder and the homeowner. Section 5 of the bill is our limitations. I understand that after talking with a number of construction lawyers that there are some concerns that some of the construction bar may have over the way this is worded, and I'm concerned about some of those things. I think we're willing to discuss some changes in order to make it more clear. But there weren't any changes in Section 5 of the bill. That remains the same, and basically there are limitations. Section 6 deals with common interest communities, and it's basically setting up a process for those consumers who live in townhomes. So there can't just be a big class action lawsuit, that the common interest communities have to go, the people who live in townhomes have to go through a process. There were no changes in Section 6 of the bill in the Delete All Amendment. And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that basically is a review of the bill. I think there's some information on your, hopefully at your desk, about I need to see these things in pictures. So we have a timeline that we've also handed out that you can take a look and walk through the responsibilities of the builder and the homeowner. I think to sum up what this bill does is here are the builder's basic responsibilities we're putting in law. The builder has to provide a notice of the law. The builder's obligated to respond to the consumer. The builder's obligated to create an offer to the consumer. The builder has to provide notice of the law in every contract, and the builder has to admit their legal obligation, which our attorneys are really concerned about, but we're willing to put a good faith offer on the table to our consumers and willing to put ourselves in harm's way from a legal perspective because we want to get these claims resolved. We don't want them sitting out there. What does the homeowner have to do? They got to notify the builder in writing. They already have to do that by law. The homeowner has to accept or reject the offer, and if they reject it, they have to say why. And if they allow the builder in to make repairs, they got to let him in the house. And that's kind of the bill in a nutshell.
Yeah, members, just so you know, there's in your folders, there's this with the materials that Ms. Barry Weaver was talking about.
It's the picture. The picture on the bottom that goes kind of through the timeline of what a consumer or builder has to do in terms of communication.
Yep, that's in the folder. Representative Goodwin.
I have lots of questions, but how many more people are we going to have that are scheduled to testify?
We do have 5 more people to testify. Let's hold off on questions, maybe, and if you don't mind, and we can bring the witnesses back.
Okay, then could I ask that the people that get to testify first are the people that have to go back to work and are not paid lobbyists?
That would be absolutely reasonable. I'm not sure who's who, frankly. There's Tony Goulet from Goulet Townhomes from Sauk Rapids. Why don't we take him, and then we'll skip over the last person on the agenda, and there's 3 others that have asked to testify. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Tony Goulet. I'm a builder for 29 years in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, and I'm the past president of the Builders Association of Minnesota. I just want to point out a few things from a builder's point of view. The notice of repair is a good bill because it creates the communication from the consumer to the builder. In most of the cases, the good communication is a process that takes place as the legislation and the laws that we abide by right now, like a 327A. But unfortunately, not all builders communicate with their consumers at a point that they should be. And that's one of the things that is good about this bill, is that it creates that communication back and forth and puts into law that the builder has to respond to the consumer when they send in a notice. I believe that our company can comply with this bill because the communication that we like to have is we put forth what's called a homeowner's manual that we give to our consumers that we build for. We also have a performance guidelines that gives them information on what is warranty and what is not, and how to go about the repair of it. The other thing that it does is it puts into place, we have one of the sheets in the back of our homeowner's manual that we give to our customer, and this is all attached to our contract, that actually is a work to be performed sheet. And so we give the consumer all of the tools that they need to be able to just fill this out and mail it back to the us or a builder, and then at that point in time you know how to communicate with the person in order to get into the property, in order to which subcontractors get lined up and do the repair that's needed. So I think that this bill is a good communication piece that's missing in our industry, which will increase the professionalism of our industry like we want. If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Yeah, we're going to hold off on questions at this point and go to the other testifiers. Thank you. Nancy Johnson?
We'd all come at one time.
Okay, that's great. If you could, as you each of you testify, if you could introduce yourselves, please.
Well, my name is Nancy Johnson, and I'm a homeowner, and I've gotten involved in a group. We call ourselves Minnesota Home Watch, and we're basically a group of homeowners who have been part of this horrendous problem, whether it be because of a new home construction, remodeling, or repair. And I have to say, we were at the Senate hearing last week when the bill was before the Senate committee, and I'll say to you what I said to them. Nobody asked us for our input in this bill. And we have a lot of homeowners in our group. We also have attorneys who work with homeowners and do a wonderful job of representing them. We also have engineers, building inspectors, building specialists, and they are also part of the problem, this very complex problem as well. And they haven't been asked to provide input. After the hearing last week, I was talking with one of the lobbyists, Remy Stone, and I gave her my email address because she indicated she would share the amendments with us, and also Nancy Emerson's email address, and Nancy's another homeowner. We saw these bills or this amendment when we walked in, and my representative, Barb Goodwin, told us that this was a delete. So we have not really reviewed this bill either, and I'm a little frustrated because everybody represents that this is for the homeowners, the consumers, and the builders, but this is not a bill for homeowners. This is being pushed by the National Builders Association. If you go to their website, their number one priority is to get a right to repair bill pushed through in every single state, and I think on their national website right now, they have maybe 16 states that a right to repair bill, and it goes by different names. So this is a bill that was designed by the builders industry, and it did not involve homeowners at all. So having said that, and I apologize if you think I am upset about this, but Having said that, one of the attorneys, who is also a homeowner in our group, provided a legal analysis of the original bill that was presented. And I was going through also some of the changes that were made, so I'm going to shift back and forth if you don't mind. And I know it's probably a little bit awkward, but that's sort of how we set this up. This attorney was, and his family were in a home that was 2 years old. It had a large number of building defects, as many of these new homes do. I also want to comment before I start. Pam Perry Weaver talked about the number of complaints that were provided to the Department of Commerce. I didn't file a complaint with the Department of Commerce for our issue, and neither have a lot of other homeowners if it's involved repair or remodeling issues. Many people don't even know that the Department of Commerce has a place for homeowners or consumers to go to. So I don't think that anyone can say, well, a thousand complaints isn't, you know, maybe relative to the total construction, it seems like a small number, but we really don't know what that number is. And last year, I asked Pam Perry Weaver, I said, what is your organization doing to survey your builders to find out what is the scope of the problem? You know, have you sent out, what about the materials that are being used? What about the construction techniques? What about the building codes? Have you surveyed your group to get some sort of an analysis to find out exactly what these problems are? And her response was no. I asked the same thing to Bob Johnson with the insurance industry lobbyist, and he indicated they have not. They have a wonderful website for cars. I use it all the time, the Highway Safety Institute. It's fabulous. But there's nothing for home construction, and that certainly has to be a much bigger economic impact than the automotive industry, would be my guess. But anyway, enough of that. The attorney, Brian Osselson, had some comments on the original bill. One of the first comments he had was the definition of action. He said that in the original bill, it's so broad that it pertains to any lawsuit having to do with dwellings and construction defects. By creating a new chapter of the statutes, this bill would seek to override other statutes like the housing warranty provisions in Chapters 327A. House File 733, Representative Karen Klinzing's bill, would only pertain to housing warranty actions. And often when it gets to the point of a lawsuit being filed over construction defects, claims are made under 327A, if available, under contract law, under negligence law, etc. This bill purports to place restrictions on all of those claims. I don't know if that was changed in the definition or that would now satisfy Ryan Osselson.
Excuse me.
Just a point of clarification, Mr. Chairman. I notice on the, and I see what you're referring to, a good handout. And just as homeowner and Wright County attorney, Mr. Osselson isn't the Wright County attorney. He's an attorney in Wright County. I just want to understand who he is.
He is the deputy county attorney in Wright County.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
Okay. All right. I'm going to skip over the notice because I understand that there's been some changes there. And I will also talk about the notice and opportunity to repair. And as a homeowner who's been through something like this, and some of you have heard this story before, and I won't go into it, but ours was just re-shingling our house. But what we ended up doing was hiring a third party, an independent testing company. And I think with most homeowners, whether it be remodel, repair, or new construction, there comes a point where there is a lack of trust between the builder, the contractor, and the homeowner. And I think any law that's put in place to protect or to deal with this issue should also include reimbursement of any costs for an independent third party to do testing on the part of the homeowner. The other comment that Brian had in terms of the offer to make repairs, his comment was, and this is again is on the old, this language would be an incubator for more litigation. It contains a complete bar to bringing a lawsuit if a settlement is reached under this bill and the contractor performs in accordance with that.
lots of room for disagreement there, and I certainly have to agree with him on that, and so do a lot of other members of our group. In terms of the rejection of the offer, he indicates that this language contains a provision which gives the builder a jump start should litigation occur. The homeowner cannot simply reject the builder's offer of settlement. He must set forth in detail why they rejected it. This places a possible limitation on the amount the homeowner can recover, and should an arbitrator or judge decide at some later time that the builder's offer to fix was reasonable, it's completely unacceptable. And his other comment here is that if somewhere in the process, apparently even after a lawsuit has been filed, additional defects are discovered, the homeowner must go back through the notification process. Now, I know that this was changed to some degree. I don't know if, I haven't read the language to know if it includes all defects or only defects that are similar, because that was talked about in the Senate hearing. I think once a homeowner starts this process, anything that is found out should be able to be included in whatever negotiation. I don't think a homeowner should have to start all over with the process again. I think that's an undue burden. And in fact, I don't know why this was even put in here, that you would have to start over every time you came upon a new defect, or if it wasn't similar to the ones that were already in place. The other thing that I guess that I commented on the apparently the new version is, again, going back to what Brian talked about, that the court or the arbitrator may limit the claim if they thought the offer was in good faith and a reasonable offer, and I think that's really open for interpretation. Let me tell you about the mediator that we had in our situation. We spent 8 hours in mediation. There were 4 insurance companies there. The mediator was a retired judge that came from labor and industry. He charged us 2 years ago $235 an hour. We had to have our attorney there all day with us, and he charged not quite as much, if you can believe that. So it's, you know, this whole issue of good faith and reasonable, I think it's too subjective, and I think that that whole area should just be taken out. I think it should be deleted. The last item that Brian talked about in his email was the limitations. And his concern, and again, I don't know if this has been changed, but he says it would expand the exclusions contained in the housing warranty statute and make them applicable to any claim relating to construction defects, not just those brought under 327A. It would let the builders off the hook for items where they relied on the written directive, in quotes, of a local or state building official. And he says, no disrespect here, but the building officials do not guarantee the work. And what is a written directive? And if a building official checks the box on a form, does that suffice? And then the last item is that Brian commented on is that it would place an affirmative responsibility on the consumer to exercise reasonable diligence to find any construction defects before closing on the purchase. If they do not do that, the builder is not liable. It places a whole lot of obligation on the soon-to-be new homeowners who probably don't have the wherewithal to hire a private engineer or inspector to represent their interests. Now, I guess there's a lot more that probably could be said. One of our building specialists said that in anything that's done, if this bill does pass, there should be an independent contractor that provides for the testing and also the oversight to monitor the work that's to be done. And he also suggested, and I thought this was a really good suggestion, that there be a 10-year warranty added to for the defects that were repaired, a 10-year warranty be provided to the homeowner for the cure of those defects. And so that was his. I have another email that I would just like to read.
Mr. Johnson, I just want to make sure that our other testifiers get an opportunity, and we are getting close to the end of the hearing.
Okay. Okay, let me just read. This is about two lines, and this is from a homeowner in St. Paul who's also part of this process that we've been involved with for the last 2 years. And his was a water infiltration, a faulty window stucco. And here's his comments. I'm taking it out of the paragraph here. However, the builder and the sub's representative focused totally on technicalities such as the type of notice given, when it was given, and how diligently the owner had pursued the builder to fix it. He says, I'll not address here the mediation process and its problems for the homeowner, as I'm not sure it's fixable.
Ms. Emerson or Mr. Rostedt, care to add to that?
Yep, my name is Nancy Emerson. I live in Inver Grove Heights. I have a townhome. I came down to the legislature last year because I grew up here, went to school here, went to the U. My career ended up being in California, and I returned in 1998 and bought a townhome. And the problems that existed, I couldn't quite understand what was going on. So I came down to the legislature last year, and that's when I found these different people called Minnesota Home Watch. What I also found was that there are hardly any protections. In 1982 in California, I had more protections as a homeowner than I do right here. I'm here to tell you that everything that's contained in this bill, I've already done. I did get a book at the time the purchase. I had a purchase. I did fill out the forms. I did do everything on a timely basis. But what I've gotten in return is a Peyton Cock approach to my problem. My original problem at the time of purchase, it took 18 months and a Department of Commerce intervention to get that somewhat fixed. I'm here to tell you this process doesn't work because I've already been through it. I am now currently dealing with, I'm not sure if it's a new or separate one, and I've done the process all over again. And I've gone to my insurance company. Guess what? They don't cover water damage and mold. I've gone to the association's insurance company. Guess what? They don't cover water damage or mold. I've gone every place I'm going to, and I've gotten an offer. Guess what? Cock. I have problems in my townhome. This is the most self-serving piece of legislation on behalf of the building industry I've seen in my life. There is nothing there for the homeowner. This is supposed to be a homeowner protection law. It falls so far short, it's ludicrous. In particular, the townhome portion of the law is absurd. All I can say is absurd. I don't know which text to read. I read the original one this morning, so I'm not sure which one. I also was at the Judiciary Committee meeting, and there were many, many bipartisan questions about that bill, and as a result, it was laid over. And one of the biggest ones was it is supposed to be a consumer protection bill. It is not. It is a builder protection bill because there is most people have, you know, especially from big builders, have already gone through this process. There is this big thing floating around, and I suspect I know who started it, that the homeowners want litigation. I'm here to tell you, homeowners don't want litigation. They want their homes fixed. I don't know who's perpetuating that idea, because all this stuff takes a very lengthy process, and having to look forward to expenses and out-of-pocket costs, most people can't recoup them. When I became a member of this association, there's 1,000 homeowners on our list. So the Department of Commerce stats can't be correct just based on that. People have gone bankrupt. They have been divorced. We haven't even addressed health issues of water intrusion and resulting mold. And this is a nationwide problem right now in Congress. Congressman Connors of Michigan is trying to get something passed. And this is the builder's response to it. California passed a law to do this stuff. And so there is no downside for the builder in this law either. All the burden is on the homeowner. And that's not fair, because, quite frankly, the homeowners are the victims. And and I think you all, this group is smarter than that, that this is proposed by the building industry, and you need more input from the victims of this process. Thank you.
And Mr. Rosbach?
Yeah. Hello, my name is Jack Rosbach, and I work with Air Tamarack, and we do third-party home inspections. Well, we do a lot of other inspections, too, but our major work now has become home inspections. I have been to over 100 homes. Air Tamarack has been to over 400 homes, and this is probably in the last 3 years. We estimate, well, it's just a guess on my part, but I think that we actually may have a pandemic in mold and fungal problems in our homes in the state of Minnesota, and the number could go as high as 10,000 or higher, just because of our experience with this number of homes. Our investigations are very complex. They take two people on the order, a very professional, trained, scientific people on the order of, you know, a full day apiece for two people to give a definition of what the problem in the home is. Their homeowners would have no chance to be able to do this kind of work. They often call us because they're starting to have medical problems in their houses, and they're wondering, you know, if the cause could be mold or fungal base, or they read in the newspapers about places like Woodbury where a huge number of a certain type of home have been found to be decaying. So they would have no chance to be able to define the problem in the manner that it needs to be defined in order to be corrected appropriately. About half of these homes, the correction requires that the entire external walls of the house be removed and rebuilt, and the cost generally can be above $200,000 to $300,000. So we're talking about a huge amount of cost and problematic with it. It has been our experience that the homeowner who has to pursue litigation to get it fixed correctly, because, as was said earlier, often it's people will use a tube of caulk or a type of spray or something like that and say that fixes the problem. But because of our experience with mold growth and water intrusion and condensation, this will not correct the problem at all. In fact, many times it makes it worse. Mold grows in a geometric rate, so over the first 10 years of the house, home, we don't see much clear evidence on the external part of this mold growth, although the internal walls, the sheathing of the walls could be absolutely lose their entire structure so that you can put your hand right through them. We pull the external parts of the walls off, and you can see that 30 to 40 to 50% of some of these homes are completely destroyed. So the homeowner does not have a chance to know this. They're going to assume their legal costs for their lawyer when they go in. They pay their costs for our investigation. Our investigations look at building defects, code violations, and violations of best building practices when we do these inspections. I have known homeowners who have told me the story that they have gone through years of brief dealing with their builder who did not know how to correct this problem. So just try to give the sense that it takes very competent people to be able to define the problem and to say what those needed repairs are to correct the problem so that there's some long-term solution. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you much. Okay, Dean Thompson. And we just have a few moments. We've got several bills on the calendar tomorrow. I think it's going to be hard to fit this in at that point, so we're going to try to identify a time in the not-too-distant future where we can bring this bill back. Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee.
Mr. Thompson, could you pull the microphone around, please? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dean Thompson. I'm representing the construction law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. And I was asked to review the Delete All Amendment and come and testify today here about the section's position on the bill. And the section agrees with the Builders Association of Minnesota that we have a tremendous procedural problem with consumer homeowner litigation. It puts consumers and builders into a complex commercial litigation context in which both parties lose, and it's a tremendous cost. And so it's very intriguing to see a meet and confer obligation that addresses that procedural problem, because what's needed is a procedural remedy. And the section is interested in talking more with the authors about that procedural context. But I keep emphasizing procedure because that's what this bill ought to do, is address a procedural solution. What this bill also does, however, is change the substantive rights of the parties involved in the dispute, and there the section believes it goes too far. As an example, in Section 5 of this bill, it would limit any action involving a construction defect and make a contractor not liable for any loss or damage described in Section 327A.03. That means a builder would not be liable for personal injury, would not be liable for economic loss. A builder would only be liable for the rather constrained remedies of 327A.03. Now, if we have a procedural problem here, then we should address that problem, but it's not the right way to address that problem by changing the fundamental substantive rights of the parties and making it much more difficult, perhaps impossible, for a consumer to make a claim for its damages under this piece of legislation. Moreover, in Section 6, dealing with the common owner interest in townhomes and condominiums, this legislation requires that 100% of the unit owners agree to the litigation if it affects the common elements. Well, sometimes developers retain units in a building, and of course they would never vote to sue themselves, and so a lawsuit would be prohibited unless you get 100% backing. Under Subdivision 4 of Section 6, the association can't even employ a person to perform testing unless that person is licensed and the association obtained the prior written approval of each unit's owners whose interest in the common elements is affected. Now, again, that's just a substantive prohibition against investigating your situation before you can even negotiate under the meet and confer obligations here. So the section is concerned about the substantive provisions and the substantive shifts that occur in Section 5 and 6 here. Now, returning to the procedural aspect of this bill, which the section believes has some merit, it is a very unique and good idea, I believe, that the parties are forced to meet and confer before they pursue remedies. However, the section questions whether you need to make that a condition precedent to a lawsuit. If this is a good idea to meet and confer, there would be no reason not to allow a lawsuit to be filed, but then stay that lawsuit and again force the parties to meet and confer. If a settlement's reached from the meet and confer obligation, that would be wonderful. If it's not, the lawsuit proceeds. Or you could do this before a lawsuit, but there's no fundamental reason to make this a condition precedent, as I say. There are too many complicated statute of limitations issues that are raised thereby, and the section has a great concern about that. I'll limit my comments to that, because I know you're going to discuss this at greater length tomorrow, but I wanted to let you know of the bar section's concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jocelyn Knoll, is that just furthering the testimony in the bill? Can we take that up when we take the bill up later, or would you like to comment now? Okay. At this point, the chair lays over House File 1375 for further consideration at some time in the near future. We got to see if we can work it out with tomorrow's schedule or not. Representative Goodwin.
I'm going to ask again. When we re-meet on this bill, will we have the opportunity to offer amendments then?
If we take it up tomorrow, no. But if we take it up at a future time, I'm not optimistic that we can work it in tomorrow. So that probably would open it up to amendments.
Thank you.
The chair refers to the Subcommittee on Technology and Bioscience, House Files 1548 and House File 434. The intent is we're going to hear our bills on schedule tomorrow, and then if we're able to adjourn early, the subcommittee will meet at that time. We are adjourned.